This is Professor Allen, and welcome to the Quarter Bin. In every episode of this podcast, I will summarize, criticize, discuss, and review a single issue from my comic book collection, which I will often select at random. Any book from my comic book collection is eligible, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for it. When you amortize the number of reprint stories over the actual cost paid for the issue. I mean, I think that's sort of implied. Was the issue worth 25 cents? Was it a bargain at 25 cents? Or was it still overpriced? Stay tuned and find out. For this 156th episode of the Quarter Bin Podcast, we're looking at Teen Titans Giant number 1, a.k.a. Walmart Giant Teen Titans number 1. From DC Comics, cover dated just 2018 from what I can tell. This issue was ostensibly on sale at the end of June 2018, but we'll talk about that later. First, a little feedback. Last episode, episode 155, we covered Sam Hill, P.I. number 7, and we got some comments on that one. Michael T. Geist thanked us for reminding him about the availability of public domain comics. Just another source of entertainment while I wait for libraries and local shops to reopen. Yes, Michael, absolutely. Dr. Ange also had a few things to say. Great episode, as I haven't dipped into public domain books, and now figure it might be a good time to do so. Is this character where the "what in Sam Hill is going on here" line originated from? Or did they name him that to cash in on the phrase? You know, Ange, that question was actually in my notes, and it's possible that I even asked Luke about that during the episode, but that line of conversation didn't really go anywhere, and that's what the cutting room floor is for. It was actually out of respect for our good friend, podcaster Nathaniel Wayne, that I didn't really research that fact. But I assumed that the Sam Hill expression existed first, and then the character was named as a reference to that. There is a history of fictional private eyes having pun-based names or names that are references. Mike Hammer, Thomas Magnum, Ms. Tree. So I'm guessing that that's what this is, that Sam Hill was an already existing expression, and they use that just as a catchy phrase for this fella's name. And after that, Ange got personal, referring to the episode before that, Quarter Bin 154, the Mighty Thor issue. And he says, lastly, a question I forgot from last time, and maybe a new debate for the Quarter Bin. And yes, it did in fact spark a debate. Last episode, you described the cover as an homage. And he again here is referring to that Thor 20, where Volstagg is smashing the logo a la Beta Ray Bill, a la Walt Simonson. You pronounced it homage, but I consider it an homage. Is there a definitively correct pronunciation, or is this going down the road of how do you load the dishwasher? Now, here's the thing about Ange. He is smart. He's successful, obviously, there's no doubt about that. But would you take pronunciation advice from a guy from Boston? That's a wicked hard pass for me. But when a professional editor from Scotland gets involved in a conversation about pronunciation, you should pay attention. The floor is yours, Sir Martin of Grey. Oh, it's written as homage, but it's pronounced homage. Well, by us lot over here, national and regional pronunciations are acceptable. Except when you U.S. folks say herbs instead of herbs? Just no. Now, here's the thing, because actually, I do kind of get picky about incorrect pronunciations. I try to get things right, such as James Tynan IV, Bob Wyachek. But the distinction that has to be made about a pronunciation that just sounds wrong to my ears is whether it's a word with one accepted pronunciation or multiple accepted pronunciations. Sometimes that distinction is regional. Sometimes it's just the way a word works. For example, my discipline of business, my expertise, is in the field of finance. Or maybe it's finance. Either one is acceptable. And I've never been able to figure out a logic or a pattern to the differing pronunciations. I will purposely, in a class session and certainly over the course of a semester, I will use both versions in my speech because I want students to understand that both are regularly used and both are acceptable. Lots of words fit into that category that can be pronounced a couple of ways. Again, maybe that did start off as regional dialects or through some other process, or as our friends in Canada might say, process. But there are words like aunt, aunt, crayon, crayon, that I believe can be pronounced correctly more than one way. Neither is incorrect. Either can be used. So my attitude is potato, potato, magneto, magneto. All that is to say, to my ears, both homage and homage are both acceptable ways to say the word. There's not a right or a wrong way. Of course, I could be wrong. By the way, Mart also directed me towards a couple of additional Sam Hill comics that have been produced the last handful of years by Archie, which I missed in episode 155. And I did read some of those, and I will report that in the next episode of the Quarter Bin, sort of as a follow-up. It's just that this issue that we're talking about is a 100-pager, so it's already looking to probably be an episode that's already on the long side. So I will put that off until next episode when we will have some more Sam Hill talk. And being, again, the professional editor that he is, Mart also posted a couple of spelling errors from one of those Archie issues. One was the very common your mistake, but the other one was Sam referring to a grisly crime scene. But from the spelling, you would have expected a very large and fierce bear to have been involved. Iowa's Joe Crawford reported that he loves the MLJ characters. Billy D. from Monsters and Magazine said it was a good episode, and that it's always awesome to hear from Luke. True fact, Billy, true fact. Laurel, a.k.a. Mountain Flower from the Huntress podcast, commented that this was a great way to find free comics. She also wrote in on a topic from the feedback section, and that's a topic that we've been talking about here on the network across many shows for many years, that we have come to call the topic that never ends. My annuals are filed all over the place. They can be in the box in chronological order, or in the front of the box, or even another title's box, if it's a crossover. And at this point, I know what you're thinking. How the heck is Laurel ever going to find any of her annuals in such a crazy, inconsistent system? Fortunately, she anticipated that question and provided the answer. I've got an Access database that I wrote in the late 90s that has the locations. I don't know what I'd do without it. Further proof, if you needed it, of why Laurel is so darned awesome. Social media love for that episode came from Paul from the Collected Edition, Karen from Between the Pages, the Pod Crasher, Tim Price, Philip Shropshire, Drew from Comics for Fun and Profit, Baby Skeletor, Chris Lydon, Robert Ludwig, the most sane man among us, Ed Moore from Teal Productions, Sean from Secret Wars and Beyond, Seth Tucker, Kirk Spencer, Big Five Army, Derek from the Fanholes Podcast, Gene Hendricks from The Hammer Strikes, Nine Boxer Nine, artist Lauren Skinkus, and our listeners of the year, the kind and lovely Sutherlands from the Rad Adventures Network. Well, let's start by at least introducing ourselves to the comic that we're going to cover this issue. Teen Titans 100-page Comic Giant number 1 had a cover price of $4.99 when it sold exclusively at Walmart, so you would think I got this at about a 95% markdown. Except, you know, as we've said the last handful of episodes, that about 10 or 12 episodes, I talked about possibly changing the quarter bin criteria. We had a lot of potential options, and everybody loved all of them. Well, our plan for this series of episodes, of which this is the final example, the plan is to break those long-standing rules for the podcast, and in each episode, break those rules in a different way. And this rule break is one that we actually did back in episode 142, the one that started the whole conversation, so I thought it only appropriate to bring it all around again. That was about a year ago when we covered the original Ghost Rider Rides Again, which contained full reprints of two issues. And that's important because I actually paid 50 cents for that reprint, or 25 cents per issue. That was my justification. And here, the justification is even clearer, because again, I paid 50 cents for this comic book that had three full reprints and about a 15-page original story. So we are talking well under 16 cents a piece when you amortize over the appropriate number of issues and partial issues. So this definitely counts. So this giant size issue, Teen Titans number 1, does contain, as I said, a 14-page new original story, as well as full issue reprints of Teen Titans number 1, that's from the 2003 run, Super Sons number 1, and Sideways number 1. So we're going to take a break here, play a promo, and when we get back, we'll be taking a look at each and every one of these stories contained in Teen Titans Walmart Giant number 1.
This year in 2020, we will see DC Comics celebrating the 80th anniversary of Robin, and so will Terrence, Ryan, and myself here on the podcast.
Every other episode this year, well, as long as Rob can keep everything straight, will have us following Tim Drake in the 1990s/2000s DC timeline.
The following episode, we will be joined by a selection of special guests throughout 2020. The guests will be selecting their favorite Robin and a story that connects them to the character. It could be a comic, movie, animation. Hey, wait. So, like, could we be reading Red Hood and the Outlaws on this show?
Or Nightwing?
Yeah, that's the idea.
Whoa. Wait, so you're opening the door to not just Tim Drake, but any Robin?
Yeah.
So does that mean Rick Grayson?
Yeah, like the New 52 Helena Wayne, Robin of Earth 2, heck, even the pre-crisis Robin of Earth 2? Or, dare I even say, Damian?
Batman Forever?
1950s detective in Batman stories?
Batman 66 episode?
Batgirl Stephanie Brown?
Teen Titans Robin with Wolfman and Perez? Jeff Johns and... oh no. No. Scott Lobdell? No!
Okay, while I give my co-hosts a minute or so to digest all of this information, you can find our show, Robin Everyone Loves the Drake Comic Podcast, through the BatmanUniverse.net podcasting network. also available on Apple Podcasts or wherever you traditionally listen to your podcasts from. Now, if you'll excuse me, I think Terrence might need a bottle of water or maybe a paper bag.
No, New 52.
It's going to be okay, Terrence. It's going to be okay.
Change of Tim Drake's origin.
Don't worry, Terrence.
Crazy Red Robin costume.
It'll be okay. Maybe it won't happen.
And we're back. The cover of Teen Titans Walmart Giant Number 1 by Mike McCone and Marlo Alkiza shows Wonder Girl, Kid Flash, Robin, and Connor Kent. This is taken from the cover of Teen Titans Number 1, the 2003 series, and that is one of the issues reprinted in this issue. Around that image, there are insets representing the three other stories, including an arrow pointing to a picture of Beast Boy in green gorilla mode and the notation, plus a brand new Teen Titans story. Obviously, there are a lot of pages to cover here. 100 of them, as a matter of fact, although there are a few ads, but I'll leave those to Mike Peacock to cover. But even so, this is more than 80 pages of content. So I'm going to shrink down the synopses a bit and maybe the analysis piece as well. And for format, we're going to summarize all four stories in one go and then talk about each one a little bit, then talk about the overall issue and then this Walmart initiative from readers' perspectives, I guess from Walmart's perspective and maybe from DC's perspective as well. And this issue starts with the one new story. As you probably know, these Walmart books include a new story somewhere in the 12 to 14 page range, and then three reprints, ostensibly connected to the main lead title character, although sometimes not so much. First up, as promised on the cover, a brand new Teen Titans story, 12 pages long, titled Enter the Disruptor by Dan Jurgens, with art by Scott Eaton and Wayne Faucher. We start at Titan's Tower with a green gorilla, a Beast Boy, swinging into a window with a half dozen pizza pies, promising his teammates that they're about to experience the sweet, sublime succulence of Antonio's, the finest pizza this concrete jungle has to offer. But Robin, Starfire, and Raven can't be found. And that's because they're all over at Star Labs battling a new costumed baddie, clad in a red and orange bodysuit, calls himself Disruptor. Raven transports Beast Boy there, and he joins the fight. The Star Labs director realizes that he must be here for the amplifier, but he refuses to let the baddie have it. But he just gets tossed aside by the Disruptor, who does comment that he's feeling a little drained by all this action. But the amplifier will soon solve the problem. Good thing I can disrupt tech as well as the body. As the Titans close in, the Disruptor throws the amplifier out the window and makes his escape. The Star Labs director is distraught at this, but Starfire manages to save the device, but the Disruptor does get away, and only later does the team realize that the amplifier case that he threw out the window is empty. Then on the last page, we see the Disruptor approaching a small group of cloaked figures who are threatening him for being defeated by the Teen Titans. But he shows them the amplifier, and they agree that he may be Hive material after all. Especially since you were able to do all that without exposing me, the Star Labs director says, pulling down his Hive cloak. Next time, the Disruptor has joined Hive. Teaming up with the Fearsome Five, he has one mission: kill the Teen Titans. Will the young heroes have what it takes? Come back next month to find out. This is one of the features of this collection, with the stories ending with a next time page. That is pretty dynamic. I mean, it's sort of what we might in the old days get squeezed into the last, you know, teeny tiny panel at the bottom right-hand corner of the last page. But it's set apart here on its own, that text. It has its own page and a pretty big dramatic font. Now, that does take up one page, which does make it easier to get to 100 pages, I suppose. But I still think it's not a bad design element. And the reprint stories also begin with a summary page containing language that sounds sort of adapted from maybe the previews, a blurb. Again, it's set out on its own page. And on that page, we see the words Teen Titans, and that's in the font from the cover from that 2003 run. The Teen Titans are reborn! Titans Tower was once a haven for young heroes. Now, after years of dormancy, the original Teen Titans, Cyborg, Beast Boy, Raven, and Starfire, will recruit a new generation of teen heroes. Which brings us to a reprint of Teen Titans number 1 from 2003. This title ran 100 issues, ending just as the new 52 era began in the fall of 2011. Jeff Johns was the primary writer for the first 45 issues or so of this. And the story from that first issue is extra-sized. This is a 30-pager called just Teen Titans, written by Jeff Johns, with art by Mike McCone and Mario Alchiza. We start in Smallville with the Kents dropping off Connor Kent for his first day at Smallville High. But he skips out to fly around the skies until Superman flies in for a chat with him. He tells Connor that genetics don't make him a hero and offers him an invitation. Superman asks Superboy to become part of a new group of Teen Titans. Superboy is still mourning the recent loss of Donna Troy and is unsure whether he's ready to join another team. Superman convinces him to at least give it a shot. In Gotham City, a similar conversation takes place between Batman and Robin. Robin says that Titans are Nightwing's territory and asks why Batman endorses this idea. He just thinks Robin needs to spend some time with his friends. In Keystone City, Flash speaks with Jay Garrick about allowing Impulse into the Teen Titans. Jay admits that the opportunity would give Joan and him a chance to take some time for themselves. Wally gives the go-ahead to let Bart join, but he admits he has mixed feelings about it. Starfire approaches Wonder Girl at Gateway City High School and extends the offer to her to join the Teen Titans. Cassie feels like a complete outcast at the school and feels that the Teen Titans may be exactly what she needs. These new Teen Titans show up at their HQ, Titans Tower, located near San Francisco. Although the separate generations of Titans are committed to trying to make this work, to working with each other, there is still some tension in the air. Beast Boy tries to lighten the mood, mostly by hitting on Cassie, but the deaths of former Titans Donna Troy and Lilith weigh heavily around the tower. When Connor arrives, all he can notice is Starfire, which is not unreasonable. I will point out that when Starfire approached Cassie at her high school, she did so in the girls' restroom, which is, in retrospect, a terrific idea, because if she had shown up dressed like that, where the high school boys could have seen her, that might not have improved their educational outcomes for the day. Just saying. Later that evening, after some getting-to-know-you chit-chat, someone going by the name of Snapdragon sends Robin a mysterious email which reveals confidential information concerning his new teammate, Superboy, who just happens to be looking over his shoulder at that moment. It turns out, as both of them learn, that Superboy's DNA is composed of cloned Kryptonian and human DNA samples. The human cell structure is genetically identical to Superman's arch foe, Lex Luthor. Next, when the Titans go to meet Cyborg, things don't go as planned. After a series of explosions sets Alcatraz ablaze, the Titans must act fast to save those in danger. Little do the Teen Titans know that they are the ones with targets on their backs. Watching from a distance, Deathstroke waits for his moment to strike. All in next month's issue. And next up are the Super Sons. The sons of Batman and Superman venture out into the world as a brand new superhero duo. Damian Wayne, aka Robin, and John Kent, aka Superboy, must find their own footing as they attempt to live up to their family names. Which brings us to the reprint of Super Sons number 1, cover dated April 2017. This is the first series from the Rebirth era for DC. This is not the 12-issue maxi series that came later, Adventures of the Super Sons. The story we have here is When I Grow Up, Part 1, by Peter J. Tomasi, with art by Jorge Jimenez. After a few prologue scenes, which will probably mean stuff in later issues, we start in snowy Hamilton County, 300 miles from Metropolis, with John Kent on the way to school. A substitute bus driver picks him up, and John defends a bullied kid on the way. At the school, he participates in a big snowball fight, but the bullies have put rocks in theirs. John considers using his heat vision, but resists. They are saved by the substitute bus driver, an old man, who somehow pushed a huge snowdrift off of the roof of the school? Turns out that the old man is Damian Wayne, who was also John's substitute teacher in third period. He critiques John's job performance, then drives the bus home, despite being way too young to do so. Back in Gotham City, Batman is heading out, leaving Damian behind. And he's not happy. Meanwhile, John is playing cards with his folks, and Lois continually wins because nobody can tell when she's bluffing. There is an emergency, Lois and Clark smooch, and Superman flies off. John goes to bed, only to find Damian waiting for him. They argue about which one of them would be able to beat up the other. And we see here clearly for the first time that although Damian is older, John is taller, which becomes a running theme throughout the series. Damian talks John into joining him in an investigation of break-ins and hacking attempts into LexCorp facilities. "Your name is Superboy," he tells John, which means it's time to forget going to bed on time and be super. And this really does go well for a minute or two, but just when they start climbing the outside of LexCorp Tower, they are confronted by a being in a power mech suit. Yeah, it's Luthor. Next, Lex Luthor is not happy. Will Superboy and Robin be able to escape the clutches of the power mad genius with the information they need? Do they have what it takes to work as a team when a new villain surfaces and threatens their very lives? And then lastly, we get to Sideways. High school junior Derek James was a normal kid, or at least he was before the accident. After falling through a rift into the dark matter dimension, he gained superpowers. Then everything changed. Now, as the superhero Sideways, he can portal across dimensions, and he is loving every minute of it. This is Sideways number one, cover dated April 2018. Sideways is part of the New Age of Heroes, a group of characters created during the Batman event Dark Knight's Metal, which is what that dark matter dimension stuff in the intro was all about. What we have here is fun and games. Dan DiDio, who was also moonlighting as DC's co-publisher at the time, is credited as storyteller, as is Kenneth Rocafort, with DiDio and Justin Jordan being given credit for dialogue. Rocafort and DiDio are listed as Sideways creators. We start in a teenage girl's bathroom on a Monday morning, less than an hour before the start of school. This is Ernestine, known as Ernie, a being in a full-bodied black-and-white suit appears behind her, and she smacks him so hard he lands on his butt in her bedroom. "Just because you can rift anywhere doesn't mean you should, Derek." We learn that Ernie made the Sideways costume and that these two are great friends, but she does tell him to text first before coming over unannounced. Derek steps out Sideways just before Ernie's twin sister Emmeline enters the room. We meet Derek's parents watching news reports about the events of Dark Knight's Metal. Because of the danger, his mom Helen drives him to school. He drifts off in class and we get a few pages of recap of how he got his powers during the events of Dark Knight's Metal. He can move through space and dimensions, or as he calls it, he can move sideways. After school, Derek puts on the costume and he live streams himself rifting around, but he's not in total control of his powers at this point. And over the course of these last pages, Sideways is hearing an ominous, loud voice. "Stop. Accept the crisis ultimatum. Your infractions must cease." "I said stop. Ignorance delays the inevitable. Do not task me further." "Enough. How many times must I say stop?" And then on the last page, we see this being is floating in midair, and he's about 15 feet tall, maybe 400 pounds of hugeness and muscles. "You have been judged a threat to the continued existence of this space-time frame, since you seem unwilling or unable to cease your dangerous and lawless behavior. Your sentence is death." Next, a lost phone and a death threat from an extraterrestrial keeper of time and space. When the life of a superhero goes sideways, it can land you in the hospital, and Derek James is about to find that out the hard way. Come back in August. The end. Okay, let's talk a bit about the individual stories. I'm going to give my ranking of them and comment a little about each one. Now, I went into this expecting that one would be my favorite, and that turned out to be the case. I can't remember why we picked up Super Sons when it came out, but we added it to our pull list in the Rebirth era. Maybe it was M's suggestion, I just don't recall. But I really enjoyed that then and gladly rolled into the 12-issue miniseries, which again, I enjoyed quite a bit. So I went into this reread of Super Sons number one with high expectations. And sometimes that can be dangerous. But after this reread, Super Sons remains my favorite story in this issue. The balance of adventure and fun, the light touch that the series has, all that was there. The compare and contrast of the two leads, reflective of their two contrasting sets of parental influences, all that was still there. And the spark of what would become a great young adult friendship, all that was still there, too. A very enjoyable story, and clearly the class of this collection. Next, in some order that I can't quite figure out, are the two Teen Titans stories. These are pretty different for first chapters of stories. The reprint is sort of a classic gathering story, bringing our team together to meet each other, and it did that very well. The combo of the original Titans, Starfire, Beast Boy, etc. And the next generation, Impulse, Cassie. I think that was very well done. As I've mentioned this many, many times, I was out of comics during this era. So Cassie and Bart and Connor, I don't know a lot about them. Don't have a lot of experience with them. I've certainly not read anything from this run. So I don't know how this run, how this volume, is viewed by Teen Titans fans. Paging Tom Paneris. Paging Tom Paneris. But I think as first issues go, this one was pretty solid. And of course, the new story, although beginning a storyline, is not the beginning of a new series. So we start in media res, not just in the middle of a battle, but in the middle of a situation where they're already established as a team, with history and relationships and all that baked in. And when you give a writer in this decompressed era only 12 pages to tell their first issue story, it can move along pretty briskly and get a lot done. And that twist at the end of the Star Labs chief being part of Hive, that was well done, a good surprise. Not too bad a way to start a storyline. And then we have Sideways. And bless his heart, he tried. Now, this is not the first time I've read Sideways. Derek William Crabb from the Fanholes podcast sent me a half dozen of the issues earlier in the year. So I've already read numbers 2, 3, 6, 7, 11, and 12. And my thoughts about those issues are pretty darn similar to my thoughts about this issue. And that is, a high school student in a full body covering costume with some complicated family issues? Nope. Never seen that before. Look, if you want a DC version of Spider-Man, this isn't a bad option. It's a good enough story and a good enough series. But it's so derivative. There are plenty of amazing issues that original take on this type of character, to say nothing of the spectacular issues and friendly neighborhood issues, adjectiveless issues, and web of issues. I'm just saying I don't need to go out of my way personally to read a lot more Sideways anytime soon. I've got a lot of Spidey to read first. And I can't remember who it was, maybe Fanboyamus Prime, but some listener messaged me late last year and wondered if I'd begun to see any of this New Age of Heroes line of books in cheap bins yet. And that was a no at the time, and I think it's pretty much still a no. I think they're just too new. This one doesn't really count, of course, but I think this Teen Titans one is the closest I've come to seeing any of those books, including Sideways, for cheap. Now let's move to talk about this book as a whole, to talk about the selection of stories, how they work together, and how well they fit into a title called Teen Titans. Because one of the key jobs of an editor in an anthology book is the selection, the curation process. And with some of these Walmart books, there were some head-scratching choices. The original Superman book included backups of Superman, Batman. That works. But the other ones in there were Green Lantern and the Terrifics. In the words of Superman's best friend on the internet, podcasting's Michael Bailey, huh? Now I'm just getting confused. And if I remember, there were a few other unusual combinations or selections in a few of these, but that is definitely not the case in this issue. Of course, there are enough iterations of the Teen Titans where you could have just done a book with them. Different eras, different volumes of the title. But if you're DC, I think you want to balance out different eras or different continuities. You need to be cautious about that, not to be overly confusing. These were ostensibly intended to attract normies, folks shopping at Walmart, not just us uber nerds who go to comic shops. So I think they tried to be cautious about that. So one additional straight Teen Titans story, that worked for me. Because, of course, the Super Sons, as I've said, in addition to being a title I really like, it does fit this theme. They are teens. And even though the prior story had a different Robin and a different Superboy, I think that was explained well enough to differentiate those characters from these characters. Again, that's the balance you have to strike between confusion and invitation. I've said it already, I'm biased. I like the Super Sons, so I'm inclined to see how well it fits. And the fact that both the Teen Titans reprint and the Super Sons reprint involve Lex Luthor, I'm sure that wasn't a coincidence either. And then Sideways. Poor, poor Sideways. Actually, of course, this is, again, a pretty smart choice because he fits the teen hero template, but has no connections to the other character, so you don't get that confusion. There's no risk of that. You get a total palate cleanser, but again, a hero, a storyline, a situation that broadly fits, I think, the parameters of Teen Titans. Now, when you're selecting stories for an anthology of any type of or any reprint issue, there is another consideration that I'm sure occurs, and that's consideration of a financial nature. Now, I am hypothesizing here, but I imagine that this manifests in two ways. Based on the particular contracts of a particular era, some stories are just cheaper to reprint than others, and some are much more expensive. And especially in this case, where you've got 100 pages that you have to try to make a profit at, selling for only $5, you do have to cut costs where you can. And one place where you can is going for books with a lower royalty schedule. Again, just a hypothesis. And if that's the case, then there is the flip side of that. When there will be some royalties paid, I imagine that a certain creator being in favor or out of favor with the powers that be, that could affect the selection as well. Some of the creators who feel that they've been blacklisted by DC point to the lack of their stories being reprinted as part of the evidence. And of course, at the most extreme side, I would agree with DC doing everything in their power to not ever reprint a story by Gerard Jones ever again. My point, I guess, is that the selection process can be more complicated than we fans may imagine, for good and for ill. And given that, given what I assume are some complex complexities, I think this issue did it pretty well. Now, as I'm moving towards wrapping up, let me talk about sort of the entire Walmart 100-page initiative, this whole 2-year experiment. And even there, I'm going to look at this from a couple of different perspectives. First, as fans, this was not all that smooth. The nice thing about shopping at a specialty shop, including a comic shop, is that they know their products really well, as opposed to a general merchandise store like Walmart, who doesn't know how to display and market comics, and for whom comics are just a teeny, tiny, low-margin part of what they do. These 100-pagers were hard to find. Some stores, some areas, some regions may not have even gotten them. They weren't well organized. The books themselves got nicked and bent. So for comic geeks, this was not an overwhelmingly positive experiment. But us as geeks, we're only one, and let's be honest, we're kind of a narrow group, a narrow perspective. You can't weigh the entire experiment on just how it affected us. Because I think from Walmart's perspective, it's probably hard to say, except that even with the end of the 100-page initiative, they are still clearly interested in being in the retail comic book business. And I think that's a good thing. I think that speaks well of the industry. Say what you want to about Walmart, having comic books in the world's largest retail chain, that's a good thing. And not only is Walmart still working with DC, the latest is that they're selling 4-packs of comics of recent vintage at the price of $8.98. And in addition to that, Walmart has teamed up with the new comics publisher Allegiance Arts, and there are 4 exclusive titles that are sold only at Walmart as single issues. I have not read any of these. The Futurists, Nora's Saga, Bass Reeves, or Red Rooster. But what I've heard about them has been mostly moderately to very positive. So again, comic books in Walmart is a great idea. And if it succeeds, it's a big boost to the overall industry. Sure, there are legitimate reasons to not be a fan of Walmart. But there are also snobbish, dismissive reasons to not want to be associated with the company or have your hobby associated with the company. And there are also ugly and classist reasons to not want to be associated with Walmart. But any industry, any company that has a chance to reach that huge audience, they need to do everything they can to make it work. And I give DC a lot of credit for trying. I know, when we all think about getting comic books displayed and sold in different venues, we all have our preferences. Me, personally, I think college bookstores are the perfect place for comics to be. Tom Panarese, he's probably pulling for Scholastic book fairs. Podcasting's Michael Bailey, on the other hand, would probably vote for chains of big box office supply stores. Or the Sutherlands, they would probably prefer comics to be sold at clandestine underground meetings of international assassins and hitmen. And hit women. No offense, Ruth. So we all probably agree that comics need to get out to people beyond the comic shops. We just might disagree about the extent of doing that and the manner of doing that. Now, from DC's perspective, I think this Walmart move was the first of, so far I can identify 3 moves, but there are probably more specific choices in moves that the company has made recently. From my perspective, these have happened since AT&T bought Warner Brothers. And I'm fascinated by each and every one of these. I'm talking about this Walmart initiative. I'm talking about letting Dan DiDio go. And I'm talking about cutting ties with Diamond. I don't want to spend a lot of time on this here on this episode. I do hope to talk about that maybe a little more broadly somewhere else. But I see all of these moves as moves in the same direction. And that direction is shaking up the company, seeing if they can do something to grow the industry or at least grow their market share within a steady, if not shrinking, industry, both in the short and long terms. And I might have quibbles about aspects of each of those three decisions, but I really like what I think I see behind all these moves, this shaking of the box. Again, not saying for sure that each of these was the right move for the company, but not doing anything, or at least doing the same old thing, was not working. So just doing something, having a direction. Again, I can't say I'm overly positive about the future of the industry, of the Big Two, or of DC in particular, but I think initiatives like this, like the Walmart partnership, I think they're good ideas. Not that every title was good, or issue, or story, but the idea, the concept, I approve of it. But what about what we came here to judge in particular? What about this specific example of a Walmart 100-page giant? What's the verdict on that, you may ask? The verdict on Teen Titans Giant 100-page special, number one, the Super Sons story by itself makes this a good deal at 50 cents, and the Titans reprint isn't bad. I even see how Sideways could appeal to some folks, and you throw in a new short story at the beginning. Look, 50 pages for 25 cents is pretty hard to beat, which is, of course, how 100 pages for 50 cents works out. So, of course, this is a quarter bin steal. That wraps up my coverage of Teen Titans Giant 100-page number one, bringing episode 156 of the Quarter Bin Podcast to a close. Next time, we're looking at a licensed sci-fi property that has gone through a couple versions on television and a number of comics iterations as well. The next time, in episode 157, we'll be looking at Battlestar Galactica, Classic Version, Volume 2, Number 1, a.k.a. Steampunk Battlestar Galactica 1880, Number 1, from Dynamite Comics, cover dated August 2014. If you have any questions or comments about this issue, the Walmart initiative, the future of DC Comics, Breaking My Rules, or the podcast in general, feel free to contact me. Until next episode, I'm Professor Allen, and I'll see you in the Quarter Bin. The Quarter Bin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky family podcasts. Show notes and links are available at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com, where the podcasts Uncovering the Bronze Age and Short Box Showcase also make their home. Links to Facebook and Twitter are there as well. Feedback for the show is welcome at relativelygeeky@gmail.com. And if you like what we've got going here, please leave a review and a rating in iTunes. It'll help more people discover the show. Thanks again for listening. Professor!